size. I was trying to squeeze everything into 2 hours, and that was probably a big mistake. But I did want to say, if you got the general impression, then if you look at those fact sheets that you received in English and Chinese, I think you'll get a fairly good reminder of some of the evidence for God and for the intelligence of God in creation, and that might be substantial enough. Today, we're going to do a totally different topic. I literally have two lives. I have this kind of physics and faith life, and I also have an ethics and organizational leadership life. And I have two institutes, and I'm bifurcated between both institutes. But today I want to just stick with a model which has really been working for me in this whole area of integrity leadership. I'm going to save the leadership piece for the ending part when we talk about culture. But right now I just want to say, how did we get into this whole model of the four levels of happiness? When I was teaching at Georgetown University many years ago, I began to do some surveying of alumni. And I would ask them, did you learn anything in your ethics course? And they would always say, oh yes, you know, we learned how to solve these cases, and we learned the difference between a utilitarian and a deontologist. And we still remember all of that. And I thought, oh, that's great, that's great. I said, well, just a quick follow-up. Do you use anything that you learned in your ethics course in your business life? They said, oh, no. We live in the real world. And the moment they said that, it really alarmed me that our ethics courses were completely ineffectual. They were, as it were, hitting the mind, the level of concept and abstraction, but they weren't getting to the level of choice, of will, and of heart. So I decided to kind of try a new model. And just to give you a basic, very basic history of it, and then I will move right into the model itself. I decided to go back to a statement of Aristotle's to see if it would be applicable. Aristotle said, happiness is the one thing you can choose in and for itself. Everything else is chosen for the sake of happiness. In other words, what Aristotle was trying to say is that this one word and the way we conceive of that one word, happiness, in our minds, in both our conscious and subconscious minds, that will determine how we interpret success. It will interpret how we will interpret ethics or morality, how we will find ourselves, you know, having a purposeful life or not a purposeful life. And so I decided to back up one step and say, okay, where did Aristotle get this from, and can I glean anything else from him? And basically, Aristotle had this theory that happiness was the fulfillment of a desire, and unhappiness was the non-fulfillment of a fundamental desire. So all I had to do was identify, well, what are the fundamental desires? And then I could also identify what kinds of happiness there would be. Aristotle also had another view, namely that the way we interpret happiness, the one thing that we consider to be the dominant view of happiness, will wind up being our purpose in life. So if we think happiness level one, that's what really matters, that's where we put the accent of the dominance, level one will become my purpose in life. I'll explain all this in a moment. But he basically had a little system. Desire leads to happiness if it's fulfilled. Happiness chosen over and over again until it becomes dominant, becomes purpose in life. Purpose in life becomes identity. And I thought, I can use that model. So then I went and I took a look at about 125 different thinkers. Your typical classical thinkers, Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, right? The usual suspects, as it were, in the Catholic theological community or in the Catholic philosophical community or in the classical philosophical community. I took a look at all these things and I said, well, what do these people think fundamental desires are or fundamental happiness is? And I came up with four different things that they suggested, and I've called them levels, and I'll explain them in a moment. And then I went out and I said, okay, what does contemporary philosophy have to say? So I took several Catholic thinkers, Bob Shaler, for example, and what did he think happiness was? Gabriel Marcel, a famous Catholic French philosopher, what did he think happiness was? Then I took a famous Jewish philosopher, Martin Buber, and Abraham Heschel, and then some Protestant philosophers, Soren Kierkegaard, for example, and then in the more modern, in a more contemporary era, people like Carl Jaspers, Paul Ricoeur, and others. And I said, okay, is there anything similar to the classical views of happiness? And there was. Then I went out to the psychologists, and essentially I looked at Erikson's growth model, and then I looked at Kohlberg's moral stages of development, and a variety of other stages, including Maslowian conditioning and need hierarchy. And then finally went to anthropology as well and said, okay, so what is the kind of universal picture that I get from classical philosophy, classical and contemporary theology, psychology, and anthropology? This is the residual of what I came up with, which I call four levels of happiness. Those four levels, as you'll see, the reason they're organized into levels is because the bottom level is the least pervasive, enduring, and deep, and the top level is the most pervasive, enduring, and deep. The bottom level is the most intense, immediately gratifying, and surface apparent. The top level is less intense, it is less immediately gratifying, so delays in gratification are required, and it is less surface apparent. So you're going to have to study or do something to kind of get to the bottom of the picture. Okay, so essentially I organized them into that hierarchy, which by the way corresponds to the hierarchy of happiness in Augustine's Confessions. And also corresponds to the hierarchy of happiness in Thomas Aquinas. Quite accidentally, I did not go to the Summa Contra Gentiles and say, how did Thomas arrange this? After I had finished arranging it, I noticed the coincidence. So I think it's a rather remarkable kind of coincidence and something that we as Catholics can use. But here's the good part about it. I beta tested this first in about five organizations that had, employees at around 5,000 employees per organization. When I found out in the beta tests that these worked very, very well, in other words, the people who actually underwent the course responded very positively to three basic areas of questioning. Number one, do you think this helps you with your own life, your own purpose in life, your own sense of direction, with your own sense of happiness, with your own sense of perhaps what might have been causing unhappiness in your life, etc. So in other words, what about you? Did it help you? Number two, did it help you with your family life, your community life, etc., your organizational life, and so forth? And then finally, did it help you to be ethical? Do you think that there's something in here that frees you to choose the right thing to do and not just to think about the correct model or think about how to solve the case correctly, but really would motivate you to choose to do the ethical thing? thing. We received exceedingly positive results on that with the smaller organizations. I then went to four major organizations who had more than 60,000 employees each. So Costco at the time had about 70,000 employees. Boeing at the time had 170,000 employees. Then we went to two big branches of Toyota and to Caterpillar. You can see what the CEOs of those companies, Alan Mulally, who at the time was at Boeing, he's now the CEO of Ford Motor Corporation, and then Jim Senegal from Costco, and Willard's here from Caterpillar and so forth. The testimonies reveal that this really works in the organization. So it's a really good system. It's very much grounded, I mean, in our Catholic philosophy. I'm not kidding you. It corresponds to contemporary psychology. It works wonders within not only the organizational setting, particularly for organizational ethics and organizational leadership, and I'll get to a lot more of that in the talk today. But also, it has a very profound effect on the individual themselves, and a profound effect also on the individual's family and community life. Okay, that's the story of the model. So it has been tested quite a bit. We used an objective test that was developed by an organization called Human Synergistics, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the University of Michigan there. And of course, that test, we administer it before and after. But the test is oriented toward organizational culture. And we can show very conclusively, after using the test again and again, that it improves organizational culture significantly. The test is divided into a circumplex. It has three parts. Passive defensive culture, which is like a fear-based culture. Everybody waits around for the boss to tell them exactly what to do, and they take no initiative whatsoever, and they're scared to death to make a move. Then you have the aggressive defensive culture, filled with hubris, right, and basically believes it can take any risk and do anything, da da da. But we have significant data that passive defensive and aggressive defensive cultures basically at the end of the day don't work very well. Constructive cultures do work very well, and as we shall see in a moment, a constructive culture, for those of you who are leaders, a constructive culture is correlatable with level three, the contributive identity. Now, the reason that I'm just saying this is if you're interested in the organizational leadership point of view, you know, there's no place like the for-profit market to test anything because they're merciless. If they don't get profitable results from cultural improvement, they will kill you. And so at the end of the day, I think this model works not only in the for-profit area, it works even better in the non-profit, Catholic, and NGO areas, even better. But just to give you a sense of what's going on in culture today, you know, people say, oh, is culture important in leadership? The culture of the organization is exceedingly, exceedingly important. This is from a Connor and Heskett study that was done about 10 years ago. James Connor and John Heskett were two guys who, at Harvard Business School who did an 11-year study. And in the 11-year study, they actually assessed really organizations, pretty big ones. I mean, these were organizations that basically had 20,000-30,000 employees. But essentially, these organizations, over an 11-year period, some of them had passive defensive cultures, some of them had aggressive defensive cultures, and some of them had constructive cultures. Essentially, the ones that had the constructive cultures outperformed the passive defensive and aggressive defensive cultures, I get this, 650% in 11 years in net profits and 500% in 11 years in gross profits. Not even when academic organizations, we don't care about net profits and gross profits per se. But that is a really a measurement of how powerful culture is. And we'd be crazy as organizational leaders, and all of us here are organizational leaders in one capacity or another. We'd be crazy not to look at that statistic and go, whoa, have I been considering culture enough? I was actually shocked to read the Connor Heskett study. But essentially, this study has been verified and re-verified again and again since they published it about 10 years ago. What's the key thought, and how can I link all this material together? I think these four levels of happiness hold the key not only to individual happiness, I think they also hold the key to profound meaning in life. How can we push people's meaning in life to the next level and the next level? So it really holds a key for us as religious leaders. We have a stake in getting people to level 3 and level 4. We have a stake in trying to get people to have a less superficial and a more profound, more pervasive, more enduring and deep meaning in their lives. I mean, that's what we're all about, and that's why we're in the priestly business, the religion business, if I can put it so crudely. But the key thing is, in addition to that, what it can do for our organizational cultures, parish cultures, school cultures, seminary cultures, diocesan cultures, this stuff really, really does work. And we have tested, verifiable results. Let me explain the system to you. Desire number one, which corresponds to level number one, so I'm starting from the bottom of here. By the way, I think you have these sheets as well, which starts at the bottom there. Desire number one is anything that comes from the outside and stimulates biophysically. Okay? So it would be a biophysical stimulation of some sort. And what would be entailed by that? Bob Spitzer sees the ice cream cone, lunges toward the ice cream cone, wolfs it down, and goes yelling. It satisfies the biophysical desire, and after it satisfies the biophysical desire, it makes me happy. I'm genuinely happy. I see the Mercedes 500 E-Class with the leather upholstery. And even though I've taken a vow of poverty, I sit in that nice Mercedes with the German engineering, whirring around the corner and feeling the kinesthetic pleasures, all of that wonderful motion, and I'm happy. Very simple, very biophysical. It corresponds to biological opportunities and dangers. On this level, then, we are dealing basically with animal sensing consciousness. As we move ahead, we are not. There's an observation made by a Catholic philosopher by the name of Bernard Lonergan a long time ago, which corresponded to a series of studies that were done in the 1960s. And he summarized these studies of animal behavior versus human behavior as follows. When animals run out of biological opportunities and dangers, that is to say, you stop giving them level one satisfactions, you stop petting them and having the affection, you stop feeding them, you don't threaten them, that's a biological danger. In other words, when they run out of anything which is biophysical and instinctual, animals literally fall asleep. They slip out of their state of conation and just simply fall asleep, including higher primates. Not humans. Humans are busy doing 2, 3, and 4. And that makes all the difference. Why do humans do 2, 3, and 4? First and foremost, because humans have self-consciousness. And that produces two additional levels of desire. Most of you, having been through philosophy, know self-consciousness or self-awareness comes from the ability not only to be aware of my hand, but aware that I'm aware of my hand, and even my awareness that I'm aware of my awareness. I mean, the minute I do that, I have my own inner universe. And what the existential philosophers have discovered is that anyone who is self-conscious or self-aware, what they ultimately wind up doing is not only creating their own universe, but opposing their inner universe to the outer universe. And that can go in two directions. It can go in what we're going to call ego in, or it can go to ego out, which is number three. Level two is ego in. In other words, I want to bring the outer world under the dominion of my inner world. How does it work? Basically, we call it ego comparative. Ego, I in Latin, self-consciousness, inner world. I want an ego gratification, and I get my ego gratification from a comparison, and we'll call it a beneficial comparative advantage. Who's achieving more? Who's achieving less? Who's more intelligent? Who's less intelligent? Who's got more status? Who's got less status? Who's more popular? Who's less popular? Who's winning? Who's losing? Who's got more power? Who's got less power? Who's got more control? Who's got less control? You'll notice the neurotic tone in my voice is increasing with the asking of each of the questions. Why? Because we can make this an identity focus. So remember, any one of these levels of desire and happiness can become a dominant. When it becomes a dominant, and the only thing that really matters to me, the one, you know, kind of satisfaction that really matters to me, it becomes my purpose in life and my identity. And so it's frequently called an identity dominant. Here then, in level two, we notice that, of course, it's not just the questions, but we notice how intentionality takes the question and kind of literally it makes my entire worldview subjected to it. So I'm always over against you. I always have to be, as it were, comparing myself to you in a kind of a competition with you, trying to establish some kind of superiority over you. It doesn't matter what it's in. It could be intellectual things, it could be achievements, it could be power, it could be whatever, but it's always over against. And the idea is to bring you under the dominion of me. And you say, well, isn't this a rather rotten way to live? No, not really. The reason God gave us these things is because I think they're really necessary. And after all, a desire for achievement is exceedingly important. Unless it becomes the only thing that matters. More on that in a moment. A desire for intellectual development is exceedingly important unless it becomes the only thing that matters. A desire for status or admiration, if it becomes an end in itself, is a terrible thing. But if it gives you enough credibility to get an audience so you can do some good with it, then it's a good thing. All of these, even power and control. The desire for power and control, as long as it's a desire for power and control to do some good beyond myself, is a good thing. But when it becomes an end in itself, it is really almost a terrorist sort of a thought. So I'm going to explain the other two levels, and I'm going to come back to this. Because what I'm going to show is when level two becomes an end in itself, it leads to jealousy, fear of failure, fear of loss of esteem, ego sensitivities, inferiority, superiority, contempt of others, loneliness, ressentiment, and a variety of other things which actually are almost endemic to the entire culture right now and tend to cause incredible problems with our young people as well as our young adults and adults. So in other words, you can see that all the cultural angst going on is arising out of a mistake. It's turning level two into an end in itself. It's turning level two into the identity dominant. And this is causing individual angst and cultural angst. When I say cultural, I mean organizational cultural angst as well as societal cultural angst. In other words, it's really killing our cultures, killing our families, and killing our society. It does a grand sweep. More on that in a moment. Let's get to level three for just a second. Level three is a very, very different approach to identity and happiness. Just as we're hardwired because we have self-consciousness, because we have an ego, because we have an inner universe to try and dominate things, bring it under our subjection, and even, you know, to focus the control on ourselves, the key thing is it also can give rise to the opposite. I could actually desire to invest my inner world in the larger outer world. Instead of to dominate the outer world or bring it under my control, rather, I would like to instead invest myself in the outer world. I would like to make the world a better place for my having lived. I would literally like to make the optimal positive difference to the world before I die, a kind of optimal legacy to the world before I die. Now, when I say this in a big corporation like Boeing or Costco or Ford or something, when I talk about this, people go, gosh, yeah, I really do believe that. I would like to make the world a better place for my having lived. Because no one wants to get to 80 years old and go, now what was the difference between the value of my life and that of a rock? And have to say, well, nothing. The rock probably did more for the world than me. That would be incipient despair. I mean, no one could stand it. So if that were the case, then the opposite is also true. In other words, the more difference I make, the more spirited I become, the more meaningful my life becomes, the more of a legacy I can have, the more it seems like my life has significance, the more substance there seems to be to me in an interesting sort of way. And let's call this the number two level ego comparative, and let's call the number three level the contributive identity or the contributive form of happiness. By the way, for those of you who like Latin, Latin conveniently has four words for happiness, right? So this would be laetus, this would be felix, this would be beatus, and that would be sublimitas. And so you basically, if you read Augustine's Confessions, he very conveniently uses four different words for happiness. Unfortunately, in English, there is happiness, 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 and happiness, which leads to a fundamental confusion. I mean, our kids will literally say, I'm unhappy. You say, why are you unhappy? I don't know. They have no idea. They don't even have a menu. They don't even know where to turn because it's not built into their linguistic system. They just don't have words to talk about different kinds of happiness. They don't even know what level they're unhappy on. But let's get back to the contributive for just a moment. The contributive thing then is when I make the world a better place, right? When I make my little part of the world a better place, perhaps my family, I mean, I have to do something optimally positive for my family or my friends or my community, or if I have faith for my church or for the kingdom of God, or if I'm lucky, maybe for the society or for the culture. When I'm really making a difference to family and friends and organization, community, kingdom of God, church, culture, society, when I'm actually having a life that's doing something significant for a range of different things, all of a sudden, you feel a genuine surge of spirit and meaning and purpose in life, and it makes you happy. It feels different from level 2 ego comparative satisfaction, and feels different from biophysical satisfaction. So again, it is a form of happiness. Could you be unhappy on level 2 and very happy on level 3? Yes. Could there be happiness conflicts, or your desire for level 3 happiness conflicts with level 2 happiness? Absolutely. And this is part of the problem when young people do. They don't diagnose whether they're internally conflicted about what they are looking for in their lives or looking for in their happiness. And of course, Aristotle recognized that a long time ago, right? Your definition of happiness is everything. That's the way you're going to judge yourself. You say, you know, is my life going well? And maybe on level 3 it is, and maybe on level 2 it's not. But if you say level 2 is the only thing that matters to me, then your answer is no. But if level 3 is what fundamentally matters to you, then yes. Even though there's a conflict. So there's it's very interesting, because it gives the kids, but most especially it gives the young adults, a whole model to use. How do you get level 3 happiness? And you can get it from doing something or simply being with somebody. So in other words, doing is an obvious thing. Maybe you write a book and it benefits a lot of people, or you invent an organizational system and it benefits the diocese, or you went out and raised a lot of money and got a hospital built and helped a lot of people, etc. So doing is the obvious way of getting some contributive happiness. But empathy is also equally important. In other words, just being with people and keeping people, as it were, in a sense of personal love and God's love. Empathy alone makes the world a better place. This came crashing home to me. You know, I read it in Paul Ricoeur and Gabriel Marcel about 20 different times, and of course, it's been bounced off of me. Good empathy, okay, but we're all about doing. And it came out of courses one day. I'm sitting there with my nieces, and I had this article. I had to get it done. The editor of the journal was, kind of pounding on me. And so I was really kind of a little bit desperate. And so my little nieces come up and say, "Uncle Bobby, could you play Crazy Eights with us?" I thought, I hate that game, and I got this article to do. But it suddenly occurred to me, it finally made sense, that if I played Crazy Eights with them and gave them some sort of sense that they mattered, that they had some dignity, spent some time with them and just loved them, that would probably do more good for the world than the article I was about to write that would probably be read by about 20 people at the most. So I played Crazy Eights with them. Now you can say, irresponsible. I thought, that was a great decision. What's my point? Empathy, doing, both important. Being with God in prayer, empathy, really important, etc. Okay, level 4. Interestingly enough, people like Plato and Aristotle recognizes right away, Augustine and Aquinas recognizes right away, anybody who has any religious sensibility recognizes level 4 right away. But, as I will mention in a moment, even empirical psychologists like Maslow even know that this is an important level. What does it mean? It's basically that human beings not only have an ego, but if I can use Plato's terminology, we have 5 transcendent desires. I talk about those transcendent desires in chapter 8 of my book, Blueprints for the Existence of God. And I just will give them to you right now. The first one is the desire for perfect and unconditional truth. And the person I use for the analysis of this is Bernard Lonergan's book, Insight, where he talks about the notion of being, in other words, that all of us have the notion of complete intelligibility within us. And this causes us not only to be insatiably curious, but it actually causes us to be insatiably curious about knowing everything that there is to know about everything, and that we have some notional awareness of everything about everything. So when some concept simply doesn't correspond to it, we just keep asking another question again and again and again and again. But there's something about human beings that seek knowledge for knowledge's own sake and keep insatiably answering questions. It is unbelievable how this corresponds to Kurt Gödel's, or some of you guys have math whizzes. There's a great book called Gödel's Proof, which is about a mathematician, Kurt Gödel. And of course, he has this kind of proof that human intelligence is not like regular, algorithmically structured, artificial intelligence, if I can put it that way. Basically, any intelligence which has to be fed the algorithms to analyze, any problem can never correct itself, because it will always have to use the mistaken or inadequate algorithm in order to assess the inadequacies of the algorithm itself. So it always, as it were, and I have this old German professor, he said, it blows up. It simply blows up. It's not work. I said, well, what does work? And of course, what Gödel says is human intelligence goes beyond the problematic algorithm. It has the capacity to move beyond any algorithm that it knows currently in order to correct intentionally inadequacies in the algorithms that it knows. In short, it can be creative. No one has yet responded to the Gödel proof. Roger Penrose did an update of the Gödel proof, which I talked about in chapter 8 of my new proofs book. It's human beings, we're weird. I mean, we really are inexplicably creative in our intelligence. And that's a good thing. And it's what's led to the development of culture. But what I would want to suggest is that means we're transcendent. We have, as Gödel suggested, a beyondness. We have, as Sir Arthur Eddington, the great physicist, suggested, something beyond us, the spirit. You know, he said, surges within our nature. And at the end of his defense of mysticism, this is one of the greatest mathematical physicists who ever lived, wrote a chapter called The Defense of Mysticism in his great work, The Nature of the Physical World, where he put together the equations of relativity and quantum mechanics in a single volume. And the final chapter is The Defense of Mysticism, I kid you not. And in it, he basically says there are areas of the human consciousness that are untrammeled by the domains of physics. In other words, they're not controlled by algorithmically finite structures. And then he goes on to say, you know, that in the domain of art, in the domain of beauty, in the domain of the spirit, he goes on and on and on. But science and mathematics too can scarcely challenge this warrant. Because in order for us to be curious about science and math, he intuited Gödel's proof, right? In order to do that, we already have to be beyond the current set of algorithms in order to correct them. Science can't even challenge this. In the end, he says, the light beckons ahead, and the spirit surging within our nature responds. What's that about? You're an ultimatizer. You're transcendent. I mean, Sir Arthur Eddington didn't know anything about near-death experiences or the survivability of human self-consciousness after bodily death. He already intuited he had a soul. But four other areas Plato identified. Perfect and unconditional love. Human beings have a desire for perfect and unconditional. Perfect and unconditional fairness or justice. Perfect and unconditional beauty. And perfect and unconditional being or home. Now, at the end of the day, I'm not going to go into all four of all five of these. I think many of you have already studied Platonic philosophy and so forth. But the key thing is, each and every one of these five transcendent desires finally are blended together by Augustine. when he noticed that perfect being is perfect truth. And perfect truth and perfect being are perfect goodness and perfect love. And perfect being and perfect truth and perfect goodness and perfect love are perfect beauty and perfect harmony. He notices this, and of course, he says it so eloquently in the first sentence of the Confessions when he prays to God, "For thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." What he means is that this transcendent desire that is within us is our highest desire. It's literally a desire for things eternal, for things unconditioned, for things perfect, and truth, and love, and goodness, and beauty, and being. And what he's trying to say is they all come together in God. God has made us for himself. And we can never be perfectly happy unless we can actually find satisfaction in perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. But I'm telling you, right, that you already know, obviously, this is about preaching to the choir. But I want this people buy it. They know it. Most of the time when I'm talking about this stuff at Boeing or Caterpillar, I mean, let's face it, two-thirds of my audience is not Catholic. Only one-third is Catholic. And even the Catholics are going, "Wow, I've never heard that before, but it sounds right." The point I'm trying to get to is, though, it's extremely instructive. And it gets people geared in. They get the whole menu. We have four fundamental desires. We want biophysical satisfactions. We want ego-comparative satisfactions. We want contributive or loving satisfactions. And we want transcendent and faith satisfactions. We are built with all four desires. There can be desire conflicts and everything else. And if there's four levels of desire, there's four levels of happiness. If there's four levels of happiness, there's four levels of purpose in life. If there's four levels of purpose in life, there's four levels of identity. Now here's what I want to get back to, both in church organizations and in what I'm going to call our, not just church organizations, but our for-profit and non-profit organizations outside of the church. The fundamental problem in our culture today is dominant level two. Maybe in Rome, it was dominant level one, where hedonism reigned supreme. It is not our problem today. Dominant level one occurs in about 16% of the population. The real problem child, the bad boy, is dominant level two. What's happening in dominant level two? I probably could have given you a chart called the comparison gate, but I'm just going to explain it very, very quickly to you. When somebody says that the only thing that really matters, the one kind of happiness that's really important, the one kind of satisfaction or purpose in life that really matters is popularity, status, intelligence, achievement, power, control, and winning. That's what really determines success. That's what really makes my life successful and good and happy. The moment they have lighted upon it, oh, by the way, in the United States, this starts at 15 years old. Level two ego comparative dominant starts at 15 years old, 1-5. Now, the key thought, of course, is, boy, by the time they graduate from college, they're experts. They're literally experts. So the one thing we want to do is we want to try and help them to move from dominant level two to dominant level three. The way to do this is to start with their emotional condition. What is the typical emotional condition of the person who considers ego comparative to be the one thing that matters? Remember, level two is good unless it's treated as an end in itself. It's absolutely necessary until it becomes the one form of happiness that really matters. It's the only, it's the dominant that kills you. What happens? Jealousy. You will notice a marked increase in jealousy. You will also notice in these individuals that the jealous person always has to find a way of putting somebody else down. Right? So there's going to be put downs going on. And boy, look at our youth culture. There's put downs everywhere. And some of it is just slicingly insulting. It's totally unnecessary. But acting out of jealousy, right, it almost seems like it's necessary. And then there's fear of loss of esteem. I mean, we got a bunch of kids who can't even take, you know, nationalized exams. They're so scared of doing poorly. They're so scared that that exam will reflect who they are, I mean, in their essence. I'm just a 1400 SAT. Actually, that's a pretty good one if you're just doing math and verbal. But, you know, I mean, but I'm just a 1200 SAT. I am. That's a being statement. You're an SAT score? That's you? People, so they're saying this, and they don't even realize what they're saying. They don't say, I received a 1200, or I achieved a 1200. I am one. Now, once that begins, notice the fear of loss of esteem, right? You can't even, you know, it's such a badge of dishonor to be an 1100. I can't even go to school. They will ask, you know. And of course, we all know who's smarter, who's not so smart. The judgment of life. Please note that these individuals are not saying, all right, I got a 1200. How will I use the intelligence that I have to make the most positive effect in the world that I can? This is not the question our kids are asking. This is not the question our young executives are asking. And frankly, it's not the question that our church employees are asking. When they get to ego comparative dominant, what is going on is they're associating some intelligence level with their own being, a definition of their essence. Number three, notice also that the spirit of loss of esteem keeps people up at night. It keeps them sleepless. It keeps them, right, functioning on this level of extreme inferiority. Number four, notice also that there is a whole level of just striving and grasping for whatever little status you can get and elbowing the other guy out just like it was an NCAA basketball championship. I mean, it's unbelievable. And of course, the suspicion. I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to grab my glory. But don't worry, you will not be able to do so. This is creating an extremely negative dynamic, not just in the schools, but in our organization. And I have to tell you, in Catholic organizations, it is dissembling us. It's not good. But it gets worse because the winners also suffer. It's not just the people who are jealous and the inferiority and the depression that comes from the inferiority and the fear of loss of esteem, et cetera, et cetera. The winners are getting it too. Just three quick things about winners. First thing, winners can't make mistakes in a dominant level two culture. If I came up giving a physics lecture and I pronounced the word spectroscopy as spectroscopy three times, and a colleague comes up and goes, ah, Spencer, that word spectroscopy. That's pronounced, you pronounced it spectroscopy three times. And now everyone believes you're a consummate idiot. You would believe them. You would believe that your intelligence is truly revealed by your mistake. Then you would go home and you would play that nightmarish game 100 times and then have suicidal feelings over a mispronounced word? This happens all the time. People on the verge of suicide are stupidities. Nothing. Nothing. They don't matter one bit in the whole order of salvation. Yet, they are literally willing to take their lives over trivialities. That's the winner. Winners do not get out of it. Winners are also classically ego hungry. They need continuous adulation in order to be happy. I really am superior to you. And you should have acknowledged my superiority today, but no, you did not. You pretended like you were my equal. So now I'm going to have to put you down and you're going to have to pay. In other words, I start resenting and getting even with people who will not give me the adulation that I think I deserve over against them. What's the source of this belief? Contempt. And that's what Augustine says, all the trouble begins with holding another individual in contempt. Because the minute you do that, you think they have to be subservient to you. I'm not talking about you, but I mean a person that thinks they need to be subservient to them. And then once that happens, then all of a sudden, everybody starts avoiding them. The contemptuous person, says Augustine, is fundamentally lonely. Because no one can stand to be around them except their mothers. For all intents and purposes, these people are miserable. And then Augustine nails it. They go to the final step of pitying themselves because they have not received the requisite edge. I've been there. I have done that. Augustine is right. Danger will runs. What's my point? This is a heck of a way to live. Ego sensitivities, raison d'etre, literally loneliness that comes with self-pity, right? All these things, it's crazy. You know, the jealousy, the inferiority, the superiority, the fear of loss of esteem, the paralyzing nature of just being accorded an inferior status, et cetera, et cetera. It's crazy. It's killing individuals. It's killing families, it is killing organizational cultures, and it is killing societal culture. In my opinion, if Catholic leaders want to do anything for anybody, get your people out of level two dominance as fast as you can. Without it, and by the way, your people, I mean your parishioners, not just people in your parish or not just the people in the seminary or whatever. I mean, everybody who can, just everybody. Families, children, etc. What do you do? I have found that two techniques are extremely helpful in helping people to move from level two to level three. By the way, the only way you can stop level two dominance is you have to make level two a means to serve either a level three or a level four end, or both. You can't ever get rid of level two, and you don't want to get rid of level two. Level two is what causes us to strive for excellence. But we don't want to strive for excellence as an end in itself. We want to strive for excellence in order to make a difference with our lives, with our skills. Level two is what causes us to hone our intelligence and to make ourselves more nuanced. But we don't want to do it as an end in itself. We want to do it in order to serve a good end beyond ourselves. The same thing holds true with achievement. The same thing holds true with status, which leads to credibility. If it's an end in itself, it's utterly destructive. If it serves level three or level four, it's terrific. So how do we do this? First technique really works. It's called, What Am I Looking For or Living For? What am I looking for or living for? Get people to do a sheet. Let's say, if you think that there's something to level three, if you think there's something to a contributive identity, then take out a sheet of paper and go away for a half day and write down on a piece of paper. I have students do this. I have business executives do this. It's the most important exercise they do. And I say, put down, how can I make the world a better place for my having lived? How can I optimally make the world a better place for my having lived? In my family. So in other words, what's the optimal positive difference I can make to my family? Put it down specifically and concretely. What's optimal positive difference I can make to my friends? How can I advance my friends? Especially in their salvation. Especially right, things that are eternal and things that matter. Number three, how can I make an optimal positive difference, right, to my organization? Whether it be a diocese, whether it be a business, whether it be an educational institution, how can I make an optimal positive difference to the stakeholders in that organization? The employees, the students, or the parishioners, or whoever it is. How can I make an optimal positive difference to the kingdom of God? How can I make an optimal, right? That'll last forever. How can I make an optimal positive difference to the church? How can I make an optimal positive difference to my community that I live in? How can I make an optimal positive difference to the culture or to the society if I am so lucky? If they can go away for a half a day, work it out with their spouse, or in our cases, just work it out reflectively or with a friend, come back after a half a day. I have them put down after they've got their list there, for this I came. This is a really important statement, because otherwise all you have is a goal statement. But if you put, for this I came, at the end of the statement, it makes it an identity or a purpose in life statement. It really helps the kids. So what, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do, or the business executives, doesn't matter. At the end of the day, you just help them to define their level three purpose in life. They will thank you for this. The main thing, though, is they have to review this in a contemplative way for 5 minutes a day for probably close to 6 weeks to 4 months. Why? It's not good enough to have it in the conscious mind. It has to get ingrained in the subconscious mind. And the only way to do this is habitual repetition. I hate to say it, but the only way is just repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And you say, well, what's the subconscious mind? It's the one that probably has a level two as the dominant in it. And that becomes our default drive. It's the one that's already cultivated by habit. So if I have been thinking since I was 15 years old in a dominant level two way, my subconscious is thoroughly ingrained with level two thoughts. So I mean, I could literally have, it's very easy. After 4 weeks of looking at my purpose in life, some person could come up and go, hey Spitzer, rejoice with me. My new book, which is better than yours, is about to be published. And I'm dragged in immediately. What do you mean your new book is better than mine? Your new book does not cover this and this and this and this. My book is far superior to that piece of junk. You go, wait a minute. How did I get into this? The subconscious mind goes right back to what it's used to, what its default drive is. And so, of course, at the end of the day, right, we have to be really careful that we kind of have done the homework of constant revisiting of it, but it's worth it. absolutely worth it. The second exercise that we have both the executives and the kids go through is how they're looking at people. So we have them identify the three or four or five most important people in their lives. And we go back to Gabriel Marcel's old statement, you cannot look for the good news and the bad news in someone simultaneously. If you're looking for the bad news in someone, it literally obliterates us to looking for the good news in someone. And vice versa, if we're looking for the good news, it contextualizes even the bad news that we see. So Marcel says, everything is about intentionality. It's about what you're looking for. So if you're looking for the good news, even if you see the bad news, it'll contextualize it. But if you're looking for the bad news, it's going to be very hard to see the good news and see it in and for itself. Now, what does this mean? Well, in our culture, unfortunately, the bad news is the default drive. In other words, because we are so trained in level two, because we are so ego compared, not you, but a huge percentage of the culture is so ego comparative, they can't afford to see the good news in somebody. They have to have a positive ego comparative differential. And because of that they wind up not wanting to see the good news. They default to the bad news. And furthermore, what is irritating and stupid and mean and unkind just rivets us to itself. So, I mean, honestly, it just level to the bad news rivets us to itself. So what I generally have the executives do is I just say, hey, look, just take an existential test before you start this exercise. Just go to your wife or your spouse, your friend, whoever, some significant person in your life, and just start letting your default drive have a field day. Look for the bad news. Look for what is irritating. Just focus on the irritating and the stupid and the weak and the unkind, and then add history to it. Low these many years. Just bring it out of yourself and ask yourself what your anxiety level is like. Ask yourself, do you have any empathy for that person at all? If empathy is the beginning point of all love, do you have any empathy for that person in whom you are focusing on the bad news? Number three, are people mysteries or are people problems? What are they? Are you a mystery to yourself or are you a problem to yourself? Is life an opportunity and an adventure or is life a problem? Unfortunately, the bad news viewpoint makes everything problematic. So kind of after they take their existential test, what we wind up having them do is we wind up saying, okay, if that's not good enough, now comes the exercise. Take out a piece of paper and write down the good news in the other. Focus on the little good things that they try to do. Focus on the great good things they aspire to do. Focus on their gratuitous acts of kindness. Even if you do not deserve them, they're kind to you. Their understanding of, that's really self-sacrificial love. They're forgiving to me. Focus on their delightful idiosyncrasies, things that just make them interesting. Focus on their skill sets that are complementary to your own, their strengths. And focus, too, on the ways that you have similar strengths. Focus on the ways that they are destined to reflect the very dignity and mystery of God in perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being. After you do that, ask yourself the same set of questions. What's your anxiety level like now? Can you empathize with the other? Is the other mystery or problem? Are you mystery or problem to yourself? Is life an adventure and an opportunity? Or is life a problem? It's astounding what happens. People are transformed. If they do this with about five or six significant people in their lives, honestly, it transforms them. What's my point? You say, are you telling all these business executives this? Are you telling Catholic organizational leaders this? I mean, you know, what has this got to do with business? What has this got to do with organizations? Everything. If we could go to the five commitments thing for just a second. Oh, by the way, before I get there. You know, when you're making out your manifesto, be sure to include level four if you have faith, and of course to include level four in your description of the other if you have faith. Okay, let's flip to the business or to the commitments, okay. Which is the next bit. Okay. We're probably frozen on this, but here's the thing. Remember when I was telling you about the Cotter and Heskett study? That essentially a constructive culture will outperform the defensive culture by approximately 650% net revenues and about 500% in gross revenues, you know, over the course of about 11 years. So that's 6.5 times or 5 times in approximately how would we go ahead and work that? See, the first thing we have to do is you have to get the leaders on board that a level three culture is what you want in your organization. Now, for Catholics, it's level three and level four culture. And so there's a whole, grouping of things in there that where we bring in spiritual life, and how do you develop your own spiritual life and things of that nature, which go into this curriculum. But if I'm just going with business people, what we normally say is what you're looking for is level three culture as a desirable. So that means first that the leadership team itself has got to commit itself to a level three culture, which means that they themselves will want to commit themselves to a level three dominant identity. And this is going to be really key. You have to bring the leadership team on first. Otherwise, it will not succeed. It won't succeed. Then when the leadership team is on board, that they want to be level three, that this is a good thing, they want to make an optimal positive difference with their lives, they want to have a kind of an optimal legacy, contributive legacy with their lives, that they want to see their stakeholders thrive and so forth and so on. When the stakeholder mentality is taking over both in their individual lives and on the leadership team itself, then certain that the leaders should pick out at least two facilitators in each of the major management teams. So in other words, each of the leaders in the leadership team should select some managers or administrators who will, they think, will be very good at bringing this curriculum to their teams. And so essentially, we then go down to training facilitators. And then once you have some facilitators, you can make this go across the entire organization. In fact, we put it online. If you're interested in seeing what we do with corporations, take a look at a website called learnepi.com. And that just kind of tells you the curriculum that we make for the rank and file and for the managers and so forth and so on. But essentially, what we're doing is we're trying to get them to the point where they can make five fundamental commitments, not just within the leadership team, not just within the facilitator trainers team, but essentially throughout the entire organization. With these five commitments, I'll tell you what will be the natural result in just a moment, what we found measurably to occur within the organization. Number one, the people, just stick with the first thing. So I commit to you that I am going to look for the common good and for the stakeholder good before I make an ego-comparative judgment. This is a hard commitment. Make no mistake about it. There's so much internal competition in cultures. There's so much power struggle in cultures. There's so much politics in cultures. This is, you know, this is a heck of a commitment to say that you're actually going to look for the common good of the organization or whatever it is, the parish or the school or in the for-profit domain. I'm going to look for the common good of the organization before any ego-comparative judgment, before any political play, before any kind of power play. I'm going to make my judgments based on the common good of the organization as best I can see it myself and as best I can see it with you. Will you do the same for me? Will you do the same for me? Will you promise you'll do the same thing? Before you play politics, will you look for the common good? Before you play the power game, will you look for the common good? If you fail, will you forgive me? If I fail, will you forgive me? If you fail, I will forgive you. Commitment number two. So this corresponds to our very first exercise, right? In other words, I'm going to commit myself to the good for before the bad in the hand. Number two, I commit to you that I'm going to look for the good news in you before I look for the bad news in you. What is this about? I'm going to holster my ego on commitment number one, right? I'm not going to get into the ego comparative political power game, the ego struggle. I'm going to holster it for the common good. Now what am I saying? I'm even going to holster my ego for what? To see the good, to look for the good news in you. I'm going to look for the good news in you before I see the bad news. Now for leaders, this is a very difficult thing to do because every single one of us has to make multiple evaluations every single year. You can't get around it. You got to assess a person's strengths. You got to assess their weaknesses. You got to assess whether there's a good fit or whether there isn't a good fit. You got to assess whether they got a skill set or whether they don't have a skill set. I mean, you know, geez, you know, I was in an organization that basically only had about, you know, 1,400 people in it, you know, half of whom were faculty members. But for all intents and purposes, it starts getting you into the bad news syndrome. Where are the weaknesses? What's not fitting right? But what I am going to say is, this works every time. Start with looking for what's good. Where is there a fit? Where is there a skill set? Where is there effectiveness? Where's the good news? Then, okay, let's take a look at where there isn't one. I find in my own life that when I evaluate on this basis, my entire team calms down. They actually know I'm trying to find out what's good before I find out what's bad or weak. It causes people to calm down. Second thing is once they figure that out and they treat others in the same way, the entire team calms down. And miraculously, you get open communication. People actually try to help out other people. So where people have a weakness, you can just say, hey, can you guys get together? And can you take part A, Harry? And Mary, can you take part B? And Harry and Mary don't get offended. They go, you know, you're probably right. I'm better at part A, and he's better at part B. Thank you, right? We don't have to play the ego game. We don't have to pretend like we know something that we don't know, or we can do something we can't do. People just are okay, you're okay. You know, and what you get then is what's called cross-functional teaming. And cross-functional teaming is ideal because everybody can't do everything. And the key thing is, if you can get open communication in cross-functional teaming, you will outperform any team. And more importantly, the third thing you will get, you will get esprit de corps. When people just calm down, realize where their strengths and weaknesses are, work together with other people for optimal advantage and communication in the team. You know, they know one another's strengths and weaknesses. They operate with trust. They operate with the sense that there is goodwill and empathy and friendship in the atmosphere. Instead of, I'm going to judge you. There you go again. You can't even do a simple algorithm. You know what I mean? One statement, blammo. The whole thing just blows up. So the key thing is, if we can get them up to a point where they got really efficient, openly communicative, cross-functional teams where people recognize strengths and weaknesses in other people, and they in the team figure out a way to get optimal advantage, it's just stunning what can take place. The results can literally, you can get rid of lethargy on the team, you can literally get rid of all kinds of unwarranted fears on the team, and you can get that team into maximal advantage, into a state where they're actually looking for opportunities and they're doing self-initiated quality improvement. I'm not kidding you. I'll just say I worked with a very large automobile manufacturer a while ago. And they were extremely effective in five parts of the United States, but in the sixth part of the United States, they were terribly ineffective. I mean, everything was blowing up. By the time we got finished talking about our four levels of happiness, by the time we got through the two exercises, by the time we got through these five levels of commitment, and then took them through a course on how to deal with one another's strengths and weaknesses in cross-functional teams, we pretty much brought that whole division from a negative situation. In other words, they were performing not negatively with respect to others, but negatively with respect to the whole industry norm. I mean, like they were five notches below the other divisions. We brought them up in a period of about 4 months. We took the labor relations issues, right? Terrible labor conflicts and everything else. The thing just disappeared. All because of this crazy idea of actually looking for the good news in somebody and then figuring out how to make the fit within the team itself in an openly communicative area. Third commitment. I'm going to look for the who in you before the what. One of the big problems that's taking place right now with so-called process management techniques is that people are getting treated like things. They're getting treated like objects. They're getting treated as if they really don't have a human personality, that they don't have a soul. All they are a skill set and a utility function. And so for all intents and purposes, it's becoming a rather difficult thing out there to control. No one wants to be treated like a thing. No one. No one wants to be objectified or thingified. So for all intents and purposes, when they get thingified or objectified, if all they are is a cog in the machine, then they tend to be very passive aggressive. You know what I mean by passive aggressive? They won't directly confront you. They'll just go, "Oh, Spitzer, yes, thank you for your request." Oh, 2 weeks later, I don't know how that got on the bottom of the pile, but I haven't gotten to it yet. It's okay, right? No. You know what I mean? No! But by that time, of course, it's too late. Yeah. You know, the passive-aggressive organization is just absolutely debilitated.
But everybody's smiling, and everybody's just doing the best they can, and everybody's just gotcha, and everybody. It's an amazingly dysfunctional organization. We find that the majority of the time, the reason is because people feel like they're nothing more than cannon fodder. They feel nothing more than an object. They don't have any personhood. There is no empathy within the organization. So what's the whole purpose of the third commitment? It's to engender empathy. You can't empathize with things. We empathize with people. And so, now I know you're priests and you understand this, but do not think for a moment even your top executive level parishioners understand this. They absolutely do not understand the importance of empathy. This is normal for us. We get it. They need to be actually shepherded through this so they can see the importance of having some sensitivity to the personhood of another. Empathy is that ability that we all have to connect with another human being almost like a sympathetic vibration, or by just looking at the human being through the eyes, which are the windows to the soul, we can actually intuit for a moment their unique goodness and lovability and transcendence. Some people just do this naturally. Some people, it takes us a long time, including myself, to kind of develop a good, authentic habit. But at the end of the day, it's worth it. The organization that has intrinsic empathy is the organization that is free from passive-aggressive and aggressive-defensive tactics which kill it. People want to be liked. People want to be in some kind of a friendship where they feel a trust. People want to be people and not things. And they sure do not want to be cannon fodder. Now this has many of you have heard of all the things that are going on in what's called change leadership and change management today. And to be very frank with you, the literature is replete with all the studies that have been done on change management. But I have to tell you, this is the number one important factor. People are willing to change in an empathetic atmosphere. I mean, I think we as priests are just going to go, duh. But a lot of people do not know this. They are scared to death of you. If they see no response emotively from you, if they have no sensitivity to be able to trust you in any way, I am not kidding you. Every time you ask them to change, the heel marks will be ground into the carpet all the way across the floor. They won't do it. They will resist it. It doesn't matter whether it's a new technology or anything else. Empathy frees people to make change. If you had all the other things in line, you're the most politically correct organization there is, and you bring in Peter Block to do seminars on teaming, and you bring in Jim Collins to bring in seminars from good to great, and you bring in all the other tools about change management, and you've got everything going for you, and you have no empathy, it's a waste of money. It is a complete waste of money. Empathy is the key, and that's the commitment. I'm going to treat you like a person. I'm going to treat you like a friend. I'm going to treat you like a human being with a soul before I look at your skill set and utility function. I want to connect with you empathetically as a person before I connect with you as a resume. Point number four. The fourth commitment only makes sense when the other three commitments have been taken. To speak about a win-win relationship with people, or to ask them to engage in a win-win relationship when there is no empathy, when there is no sensitivity to the good news in them, and when no one is looking for the common good, when the entire atmosphere is charged with politics, when the entire atmosphere is charged with negative judgments and with gossip, and the entire atmosphere is anti-teaming, is absolutely a waste of time. This comes from Stephen Covey. You can bring Stephen Covey into your organization tomorrow to bring in the win-win relationship. And for all intents and purposes, he will fail if people have not taken the first three commitments. And you know this, and you're priests. I think we all intuit this. But this is absolutely cutting edge organizational leadership. It's leadership from the heart. It's leadership from culture. It's a leadership from our commitments. But the key thing is it works. And it gets incredible results. We have this tested, as I said before, with human synergistics, where we have a circumplex for every single company we have worked with. And we have seen the passive defensive and the aggressive defensive parts of the circumplex literally dwindle. And we've seen the constructive parts of the circumplex literally come alive by taking these commitments. Obviously, you have to have a sufficient education to make it work, but you get the point. What's the win-win all about? The win-win is predicated, as I said, on the other three commitments, but it's also predicated on what we call the stakeholder mentality. And that means that we have to be devoted to every one of our stakeholder groups. We have to look at every one of them. So for for-profit companies, right, it's their customers, and it's their suppliers of materials. It's obviously their employees. It's the community in which they're situated, say Hong Kong or a part of Hong Kong. It's the management and stockholders and so forth and so on. So we have all these various stakeholders. In a school, it's the students, and it's the parents, and it's the teachers, and it's the benefactors and friends, and it's the board, and so forth and so on. Okay, now, the key thing is we want all of our stakeholder groups to be in some way to receive a win-win. And we also want our organization to be part of the win-win. Every single time I had a controversial decision that I had to make, one that I knew was going to upset somebody or a group of people, I would get out in front of that whole thing and I would give the logic of the win-win. I didn't put it in the words win-win. But what I did was I went out and I just said, okay, what's this decision going to do for the common good of the organization? What's this decision going to do for stakeholder group A and stakeholder group B and stakeholder group C and stakeholder group D? And then I would be purely rational. Just be thinking machines. And I would get out there and I'd say, this is the way I see it. I see that we can do the most amount of good and the least amount of damage if we do this, this, and this in this order. I'm willing to listen to you. If you have another thing, but bring the stakeholder groups together. Don't address the stakeholder groups one at a time. Because, of course, if you go to the faculty and you say, this is the way I see it, and this way, of course, we won't disadvantage the staff, and we won't disadvantage the students, you know, that stakeholder group might be selfish sometimes. So they might say, well, wait a minute. We are the university. What are you talking about? Of course we deserve a bigger portion of the X. But if they're sitting there with the student leaders and they're sitting there with trustees and benefactors, they're sitting there with people who are going to be disadvantaged of the staff, unlikely to say that too loudly. I generally bring them together. What I do is I bring them, I take the representatives from the staff assembly, from the faculty assembly, from the various groups. You know, I have always a couple of trustees and regents there and so forth and so on. And then I put out my logic. And it's amazing how rational people can become. Absolutely rational. A win-win works every time. But in order for a win-win to be rationally operative and workable, you've got to get ego out of the equation. Is that an ego battle should ensue before embarking on a rational structure, it won't work. Ego battles kill everything. So I ask when I begin a very controversial and difficult talk, I ask people to look for the common good before going ego comparative, before going political, before going, but I ask them to say, I really need your help. I ask them for their help. Please do this for me. Help me. Help me out here. Number two, I'm asking you to look for the good news in all the stakeholder groups. Help me out here. You know, I'm asking for this. Every stakeholder group, look for the good of the others, the good news in the other stakeholder groups. And then I ask them, I just say, you know, can we just treat each other like friends and people here? Can we do this first instead of, you know, I'm superior because I have a PhD and you are a mere staff member. Can we just treat each other like friends and people? Can we do that? Then it'll work. Fifth and final commitment. I'm going to trust you until you give me ample reason to do what I want. 98% of people will live up to your trust in them. They will. I have found it almost universally the case. People will tell me, don't trust that guy. I go and I explicitly tell them, hey, I'm going to trust you with this, this, and this. People live up to their trust. There's 2%, honestly, that don't. Those 2%, I've said over and over and over again, you know, you got to let them go. Man, if somebody intentionally violates a trust, you got to let them go. Because they're going to just keep doing it. I always tell people, if you've got a problem, let me know. If you've got some kind of sensitivity, if you've got a cash flow problem in your family, if you've got something, you know, or there's a sickness that you have, just let me know. Or let your manager know. Let somebody know. We're going to treat you like a human being in this organization. Don't get yourself into a situation where you have to do desperate things because you didn't let anybody know. But the key thing is, if you have an atmosphere like that, and then people violate trust, you got to let them go. But that's so minimal. It happens so little of the time. The more I tend to trust people, the more they live up to the level of trust. What does that eventually do with these five commitments when they go into the organization? I find I can always use three techniques after that fact. Number one, I reward people for being contributive. I do. I thank them for it. I acknowledge them. If I can, I try to promote them. I try, in some sense, even to hire them. Number two, I can always use rationality. Once ego is out of the picture, it is absolutely astounding how rational people become. Staff, faculty, they settle into just a remarkable rationality. Third thing, very important as well, is I can then, in a sense, convey my hope and my future for the organization. I'm just going to kind of conclude my remarks here on this whole area. Leaders have to write the history of their organization. But that's not the really important thing for leaders to do. Leaders need to write the future of their organization. You have to be able to tell the story about the future. What's going to happen to this organization? If we embark on this plan, if we embark on these goals, if we embark on this evangelization plan, if we embark on these goals for the number of people or the number of contributions or the number of programs that we're going to have, if we do all these things, what are we likely to become? Now, at first glance, people will always think, quite frankly, that there's a little bit of baloney in what you're saying. Especially faculty are trained to be critics. Of course, they're going to think Spencer is pie in the sky. But it is always worth painting the future and what the future will look like if the goals come to pass. When I came to Gonzaga University a long time ago, I have to tell you, we were nearly bankrupt. We were at a critical threshold in our student body that I thought was going to put us under. I thought the bankers were going to knock on my door, honest to God. We hadn't built a new building in about 6 years. And I just said, well, here's what we have to do. We're just going to have to get our admissions profile up, and we're just going to have to be admitting an additional 100 freshmen every single year without lowering the standards of admission. And of course, everybody goes, you're out of your mind. But here's the future that I predict will happen if we are able to do this plan. We can put this plan into practice, then we can launch a capital campaign, because we'll launch it on a winning foot. We launched the capital campaign. I'll wager you anything when you get $300 million from the capital campaign. If we get $300 million from the capital campaign, we can finally start building some buildings. Geez, we need a new science building worse than anything in the whole wide world. We need a new X and we need a new Y. And we come and but just think of the future here. Think of the future. And of course, after everybody, they're all kind of looking at you. You know, this is my first talk. They're all kind of looking at you and they go, we sure hope you can do all that. They kind of walk out of the room. Well, it came to pass. Every single solitary piece of that plan. Because slowly but surely, each one of those stakeholder groups started believing in the possibility. And when they believed in the possibility, it actually started to work. And what do I mean by that? We always move toward what we believe is worthy of us and what we're capable of. We will not naturally move toward what we believe we're not capable of or worthy of. Everything is about belief. If you are leaders, you must get into the belief structure of your people. And the way to do that is by painting a realistic yet definitely improved future through the goals and processes that you are proposing. We move naturally toward what we think we're capable of and worthy of. We don't when we don't. My job in coming into Gonzaga was not to raise $300 million right away. My job in coming into Gonzaga was not to go out and hire a mathematical consultant to redo our whole financial aid program and to quadruple the number of admissions visits from the students and to redo all of our marketing materials, which were just absolutely in the last century, et cetera, et cetera. That was my first job. The far more important job was to get every single one of my stakeholder people, my admissions team, believing that they were capable and worthy of 100 additional freshmen every year until we would double the student enrollment at Gonzaga without lowering the admission standards one scintilla. My job initially is to get them to believe on the financial aid team that they can redo everything in a completely new quantitative structure and that they can do it. They could use complex algorithms to assign merit and need scholarships instead. But they could do it even though they hadn't done it before. My job was to convince every single one of these deans that their faculty members were so darn good and so capable of publication that if you just gave them the time and the incentive and the money, that they could actually get out there and be an ace number one faculty. My job was to get people to believe in themselves. Because they were all capable. I sat there, I went through, here's the Dean of Engineering. He graduated top of his class from Princeton and his PhD. What? Of course he's capable. Here's the next guy. Of course, he, you know, the guy graduated from X, but you know, they're all capable. But it's all about belief. It's all about belief. Now, I'll just tell you one thing has made me always utterly successful as a leader. Because part of culture are these five commitments. But the other part of culture is a future. A future that people can really get behind. A noble future that they want to believe in. And a noble future that they can believe in because it's realistic enough. A noble future which is defined enough so that it has a kind of reality, a set of goals, and a set of processes and structures to get to the goals that they can believe in. But above all, it also has to be about a story of what we can do together in order to achieve it. And it works every single solitary time. Who's my inspiration for all of this? Back to Aristotle. Aristotle indicated that if we wanted to, in the rhetoric, that if we wanted to communicate effectively to anyone, of course the first step is to know our audience. But the second thing he said is, it takes more than logos, right? It takes more than analytical statements. Okay, here's goal number one, and goal number one is completed, that leads to goal number two. We'll get that done, that's gonna lead to three, and then once we get stage three done, then we go back and make it a cycle, blah, 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 blah. That's logos, it's logic, it's analysis, it's just statements of fact. It's A follows B, which follows C. But then he said the other thing that we needed was we needed pathos. You should not be scared of emotion or feeling. That passion and feeling were an integral part to the communication with everyone. Now, of course, among some people, there's a great suspicion about passion and feeling. But for all intents and purposes, save the pure logos for the boardroom, everyone. That's the only group that really enjoys pure logos, right? When I go to a board meeting, I sit there and mumble objective statements because that's what's expected of me.
Well, in our cash flow statement now, we're going to be going ahead and now we just projected on basic revenues that's going to be borrowed from that. And pass up the sheets here, you're giving the overhead projections, and that means net revenue cash flow advantage. Any questions?
This is boardroom talk. You're people, not the boardroom. And for all intents and purposes, they want to hear you believe your own story. And Aristotle says, you need passion to convey your belief in your own story. Passion or feeling does two things. Passion moves thought to action. Aristotle. Feelings or emotions move thought to action. If you feel nothing, you will be Donovan's brain, the great thinking machine, and nothing will come from it. It's feeling that moves thought to action. And secondly, feeling makes your belief in your story about the future believable. Third says Aristotle, ethos. The group dynamic, the group feeling. The most powerful tool you can use in ethos is story. It's narrative. Aristotle was right to tell the story about the future in a passionate and believable way. A story that has both logos and pathos. A story that literally can give them a sense of hope about their future, a sense of nobility about their future, and believability about a good and noble future is a great thing indeed. Now, what do you sow into the story? You tell everyone in the story why this is so important. If we educate this number of people at Hunsack, just imagine what we could do with future generations of people who have this kind of education. And we take this community and we use the service programs, right? I mean, we built our service programs. When I arrived at Gonzaga, we had 30,000 student hours of volunteer service. When I left 11 years later, we had 300,000 student hours. 10 times the number, because people thought it was a good thing. When I got to Gonzaga, we probably had 120 people in a student body of about 4,000 going to Mass every Sunday. When I left Gonzaga, we had 2,700 in a student body of 8,000 going to Mass every Sunday. It's all about, in a sense, taking each of these things that are the virtues that we want, right, that we want to communicate. The things that define our purpose within our ethos, our culture, right? Ethos is that sense of communal feeling that is arising out of the culture of the institution. We as leaders have to define that. And we define it with our story. We define it with the virtues and the vices within the culture, in the story. You know, Aristotle, I just think that just an incredible genius, needless to say. But the key thing is, I think that's what makes a leader. Leaders are great future storytellers. Leaders are not afraid to manifest passion to their people if they believe in something strong enough. Leaders are utterly rational. And then, if you've got a culture of goodwill, if you have a constructive culture, you can literally lead that organization to places it never even dreamt it was going. I had a development team that after a while, they became so self-efficacious and so self-motivated and so creative. I mean, every time I visit, I never had to make a suggestion, crack a whip, anything. I mean, these guys were just so good. They come in, they just go, hey, we just had this idea. Why don't you try this? And you go, wow, that's a really great idea. Of course, I never even remotely thought of it. But they're just into it. They were into it. And we became exceedingly effective. What's my point at the end of the day? Well, it all comes down to, what do we think is meaning and purpose in life? Because I really do believe that unless we get people up to level 3 to create a level 3 organization, everything else I just told you in the last half hour will be meaningless, because I really think ego-comparative cultures, ego-dominated cultures, ego-battle political power cultures simply don't work. Statistics back me up on it, but most importantly, It plays also to our young people. It helps us with our own evangelizing function. Right? We as priests and religious, right? I mean, it's pretty clear, you know, that if we can get people up to level 3, are you kidding me? Level 4 is duck soup. And that means easy to get to. Very, very easy to get to. So, I guess, you know, maybe I'll just open myself up to your questions right now, but that's what I would probably call integrity leadership, or perhaps constructive culture in leadership, or perhaps happiness, constructive culture, and integrity leadership. So, thank you very much.
Professor Spitzer, yesterday I sent